Hey, dear listener, Joshua here with a plug for our Patreon. Becoming a Fright School patron will give you the opportunity for exclusive access to bonus content, including videos, our secret show, book club, and even monthly online hangouts with us. That's right, we've been hard at work preparing all of this exciting content for you, including our brand new secret show, the After Fright School Special. Joe finally gets his revenge by making me watch his favorite films. Some of them will even be gag family friendly. We have four different monthly memberships available. The PTA Booster Club at $1, Just Auditing at $5, Full Time Load at $10, and the Faculty Lounge at $20. Every bit helps us keep Fright School going, and we are so grateful for any and all of your support. Join us over at patreon.com/frightschool. The class you never want to miss just got better.
Before we begin, we wanted to issue a content warning for this week's episode. There is a frank discussion of sexual violence, assault, and trauma that some may find disturbing.
Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Joshua.
Bonjour. Is it really you? Bonsoir. It's not really soir, but it's okay. Just to keep in the theme, you know.
Yes. Bonsoir.
Yes, we are going to try not to be awful with our French accents today, but it's probably going to be really hard. So we'll just see what happens. How art thou, dear Joseph?
I am great. All things considered, I am great.
Good. Me too. I'm very, very excited. We just got our travel passes for London so that we can ride the tube, and you know, the metro and whatever else. I'm very excited because we're doing all of this last minute. Actually, by the time this airs, we won't be gone yet, but we'll be about to leave. I forgot. It's the last episode of the month we'll be in London. So we're doing this so last minute that I was like really worried it wouldn't get here in time, but they got here in time, especially with COVID and everything still, and trying to get a delivery from London because you had to order them online. And I don't know. Anyways, it was just a mess. Thankfully, we got them in time.
You couldn't just buy them there?
For the type of pass and like the deal that we got, like, you know, for buying them online, it was just better. It was cheaper to do it that way than buy like one at a time, because it's like a full 7 days. It's like a week pass, so it gives us unlimited everything while we're there, so we don't even have to think about it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which is what we wanted to do. Look at this cute new mug I got. It's a chimera. Sorry, this is only going to be visible to the people who can watch this video.
So subscribe to our Patreon so you can see the Chimera mug. It looks like a yerba mate mug. You just need the straw.
Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was super cute, so I bought it. One of my favorite, a lot of the clothing I wear companies, they do every year, they do like a clearance sale a couple times a year. And if you wait them out, they will eventually do like a clearance sale where it's like 40% off if you buy like four clearance items. So I got a jacket and some other things, you know, for the trip. And I saw this little mug, and I also saw this little like strange, I myself am strange and unusual thing. So I was like, I'm stocked up on things to drink from. So I've been doing a lot of that. I've also been really binge watching Murder, She Done Already Sat Down and She Wrote. I've watched like two seasons of it over the last couple of days. I'm really into like the cozy mystery right now. I don't know. It's like, I'm reading the Thursday Murder Club books. There's a new one I'm waiting on. You know, I'm like enjoying like a nice cozy mystery. That show is insane. Did you ever watch Murder, She Wrote?
Murder, She Done Sat Down and She Did Write. Mm-hmm. I watched, yes. So my aunt, my auntie Rita, who used to watch us when we were kids, she had like her daily list of programs, mostly on A&E. and it was like Quincy and The Equalizer and Murder, She Done Sat Down that she wrote.
Right. So
I'm very familiar with Cabot Cove, the denizens of Cabot Cove, and one Miss Jessica Fletcher.
Right. I love that because it's kind of the same. Like, we watched it growing up. We watched a lot of it when it was new. Like, there was a couple years where I was like 7, 8, where like I think it was on Sundays. I can't remember, but I feel like I have a strong memory of like Murder, She Wrote, Unsolved Mysteries, The Simpsons, like kind of ending the weekend, you know, like we kind of watched them like bam, 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 bam. It could have been like reruns or syndication of Murder, She Wrote we were watching instead. But I do know we watched some of it new. I just can't remember what day. Again, this is 30 years ago we're talking. But that show, it is so fucking bonkers. Like, one, I love watching it with Jeffrey because he doesn't watch it so much as every time somebody comes on the camera, he goes, oh my God, that's blah, 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 blah. I mean, he'd like every, even people that like nobody would know. They've been dead for 40 years or whatever, you know, 30, what, however long it's been. You know, they died right after it because, you know, Jessica Fletcher, serial killer. But he like recognizes everybody in just in the first few episodes I watched. Like, Linda Blair popped up in one. The dad from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, I can't remember his name, the one that sprays Windex on everything. Yes, he was in an episode.
The Romany man from
yes, yes, exactly. Jeff Conway playing a terrible drag queen in another. It really is a who's that of like the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, like when they, you know, stars. Who else? One with Lynn Redgrave.
Lynn Redgrave.
Yeah, there's like a lot of people on it, but Jeffrey, he just sits there. That's such and such from MASH. I'm like, I didn't watch MASH. But anyway, so I enjoy it for that. It's fun because he just like you know how our bedroom is set up, how we have the TV. I'll be laying in bed and he will just stand with his hand on the bed staring at the TV and just going off on who everybody is, and I'm just like, I don't care. Second reason that show is fucking bonkers is I was watching one last night where a fashion guy, I guess he was like a financier, he wasn't a fashion designer himself, but he was like an investor, got shot twice because two different people, one person tried to kill him and then somebody else successfully killed him, came in to finish the job. And he's laying there dead. The wife is there, you know, obviously like, oh no, my husband's dead. The police get there and they're like, oh no, you know, this guy's dead. We got to figure this out. Are you Jessica Fletcher? I love your books. And they have the whole like conversation about what a great mystery writer she is. And Jessica's laughing. And I'm like, this woman is standing here with her husband murdered. And it's just like, that show has so many moments like that, that are just bizarre. It's like, this is, you know, well, I guess that's the other thing. The third insane thing about it is that she's allowed to investigate it all. Like, she's just she's breaking all kinds of laws, going through people's personal things, stealing things, inserting herself where she doesn't. I mean, it's nuts. But I enjoy it. It's very cozy. Get some tea, some bonbons, you know, watch some Murder. Murder, She Done, already sat down and she wrote.
My favorite is like in the opening credits where every time she has like a flashlight and she's wearing her members only jacket, like just, you know, snooping where she shouldn't be.
Yeah, it's delightful. So I've been doing that. That's been really entertaining to me. So, you know, going to the past. This might be a little sad. I don't necessarily mean to bring it down, but the day that Rakshasa died, we had left the TV running all day and it was a Parks and Rec marathon. And I was laying on the floor in the living room with him, you know, waiting for the vet to come. And so we just laid together on the floor for hours, you know, watching Parks and Rec. So I have not been able to watch it since that day. It's just anytime it's on, I change the channel or I try to avoid it. But yesterday I watched the first episode again and I remember just how fun that show is. So I don't know. It's like, it's a weird grief thing, but it's like, yeah, I couldn't watch it for the longest time. And I wasn't even conscious of it really. Cause it was like I was going through so much. It's not like I was watching it. It was just such a presence that day. And we didn't like turn the TV off and just to have it going, you know, just to have noise. And so it was just a weird thing, but I realized yesterday I watched the very, like the first episode that I've watched in like 2 years, 2+ years, whatever it is now that he's been gone. And yeah, so there's also that. So see, breaking through, silver linings, grief, all of that. We process,
we'll move on. What about you, Joe?
You contain multitudes.
I do. What about you? Have you been watching anything or seen anything? Any movie?
Nothing in, well, I did see Fire Island in theaters. Actually, this is at the beginning of the month, so this is a little late update, but James and I saw Fire Island with some friends in theaters. You weren't invited because why would I? It's men. why would I invite you? It is men.
Wait, what movie? Stream,
Fire Island.
Oh, right. Yeah, no.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's a win for API, for Asian American queer representation, but, you know, right. You probably have no interest.
I see that Margaret Cho is in it, so part of me is like, well, I do kind of want to support her. I don't know. I mean, you kind of sold me a little bit on it, like talking about it. I don't know when I'm going to watch it. I have to really I feel like I need to pick like a good queer mix of movies and like watch that with them, you know, maybe. I don't know.
It's a good plane movie. It's on Hulu, so it's good for the plane. But yes, and I found this out later that in the original script, Margaret Cho's character was actually supposed to be, was written for another man. But when that man dropped out, it just so happened that Margaret Cho got in contact with the writer and the director and said, I want to be in this film. And they reworked the part for her. And it just works so much better with her as this kind of like, you know, mother, elder lesbian figure on the island. And she's really funny in it. I was just going to say we saw that, but that was the last movie I saw in theaters.
I saw a Twitter exchange. I guess somebody was like, one, I know there was complaints about it not passing the Bechdel test, which Bechdel has come out and given it a pass herself and said that, like, this film, it's okay, which I thought was funny. And I also like that they reiterated, like, the Bechdel test isn't meant to be, like, you know, super serious. Like, it's, you know, it's started sort of, not exactly as a joke, but, you know, it's not like a super serious critical analysis of films, you know, so there can be nuance to like why a woman may not, you know, play a role in a film or not. You know, so I thought that was an interesting exchange, just kind of bringing up the Bechdel test. And then the other was somebody posted calling like all the lesbians in it drab or something. And Margaret Cho like responded and like wrote, like, I didn't know I was drab. I think I'm fab, you know, being like how Margaret is. And so that blew up. And that was the thing where everybody was talking about the lesbian representation in the film and whether or not, like, you know, the lesbians were boring. Or these matronly drab types. And I just can't imagine Margaret Cho playing, you know. But again, I didn't really follow it too much because I wasn't sure if I was going to, you know, watch the film. So again, that might be something really good actually for what? The After Fright School special, our secret show that we have available on our Patreon. That might be a good one for that. Maybe we should... we should try before, well, I don't know. I don't know about June, but maybe in July, maybe for San Diego Pride.
Yeah, we'll do a Pride Diego Pride.
Maybe we could do that for a Pride bonus kind of thing.
It's not without its, it's not without its problems, performance wise and all of that stuff. But I'm curious because like I'm assuming you've read Pride and Prejudice. So from a literary standpoint, I'm curious to see what you would have to say. I made sure
it's meant to be an interpretation.
It's an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
From what I understand, it's supposed to be a fairly faithful adaptation, but it also it centers specifically on different relationships than the book does, but yeah. It's supposed to be a pretty faithful adaptation.
I don't really remember if I've read that or not. I feel like I was forced to somewhere along the way to read it. Maybe selections from it or an abridged version of it. I feel like, but I don't know. I'd like to reread it. So maybe I'll put that on my list of things to do. Cause I mean, I think well,
you will be in Jolly Old
copy here somewhere. Oh, there we go. I'm walking around the streets reading Pride and Prejudice. That'd be funny. What else? Oh, I started Dark Winds on AMC, which is a new, it's sort of, I don't want to call it exactly a police procedural, but it is. let me see, what was it? It's on AMC. I think I'm watching an AMC Plus. And it's, you know, the it's Tony Hillerman. He's like an author. He wrote all these books. I think they've been adapted before. But this is like a new series. Yeah, based on the Leaphorn and Chi book series by Tony Hillerman. Zahn McLarnon?
Yes.
He is in it. And I like him.
From Westworld.
Yeah, he's been in all kinds and of other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm like really excited to see that. And I'm watching that. It's like a murder mystery. Again, the cop thing. Oh, it's about like, I think it's the Navajo. I think they're on Navajo land. Yeah, Navajo police officers, Joe and Jim in the 1970s. So again, it's a period piece. I love that. I love 1970s Southwest. So I started watching that. It's pretty good so far. I recommend it. Some of the critique around it, I've not completely read, but I've seen headlines and stuff talking about getting away from like trauma narratives for Native, Indigenous people, which I think is great, you know, and people are that are writing the show, you know, are Native peoples, and you know, just kind of trying to tell a different kind of story. So I'm excited to see where it goes. They've released two episodes so far, I think, dropped last Sunday or something like that, maybe this past Sunday. What I don't even know what today is anymore. but I recommend it is what I'm saying. So check it out. It's creepy. You know, I thought they were supernatural type things, but it doesn't seem to be what's going on. So I never read any of the books. I had one of the books for a long time. Somebody gave it to me and I never read it. I think it was Thief of Time or something. But I never read it. I had it when I was like a kid and I finally gave it away before we moved to this house like 8 or 9 years ago. Cause I was like, I'm never going to read this. I don't even know what it is. And now I regret that because I wish I would have read it. especially if like the books are like the series. You know, I did sneak off and see Men. I don't know if I told you that. This might be news on Fright School to Joe.
That is news to me.
Yeah, it's because I have all this time during the day and I have, you know, that AMC membership where you get 3 movies a week. I think I've paid for it for like 2 or 3 months and I've only seen like 2 movies. So it's definitely not working out. It's working out in AMC's favor because they're not having to show me any movies. But I did, I just need to get out of the house because I was like going crazy here, more crazy. And so I went and I saw Men. I enjoyed it. I need to see it again. Fucking weird. Have you seen it yet? I know we talked about it. Okay. I recommend it. We should watch it for the show at some point. Maybe give it, you know, some time, give it a few months, because I do want to see it again. But I need some more analysis to come out about it. I need to see more conversation because it was super strange. But it had some neat stuff. I don't think it's spoiling anything to say it's like, you know, the woman, she's like, you know, suffering from like a tragedy. Get away from the big city. So she's out in the middle of, you know, nowhere in a cottage in the woods. And she's harassed by some men. And it's really interesting because when she goes into the village and she like meets police officers or the mailman or, you know, a young boy, all of them are the same man. So, which I thought was really kind of cool. And I don't think, because that's like not really giving anything away because you're going to tell immediately that like all their faces, it's like the same guy in different makeup. So
yeah, it's Rory Kinnear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's really cool. Like the way it functions. I'm like, oh, this is super weird. I dig this. But the film itself, we would definitely have to watch and do a deep dive. And apologies to Final Girl Ashley, because I know she wanted us all to go see it together. And I still will. If we all want to go, we can go, because I do want to see it again. but when we do watch it, we will definitely do an episode on it, because we're all going to, you know, you're going to be like, what the fuck happened?
I actually binged a couple things on Amazon. They have there's a two-part documentary about the kids in the hall. And I watched it and it was brilliant. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Kids in the Hall. I watched like when it was in syndication and Comedy Central, when the Comedy Central's logo was the world with the little spinning globe. Yeah. So I remember watching it then and just thinking like, oh my God, this is so messed up, but it's so funny. And I don't know why I like this. I credit Kids in the Hall with my love of like the absurd and the strange in terms of comedy. So watched the two-part documentary. That was really good. And then it's in conjunction with the fact that the Kids in the Hall released a new season of television on Amazon. So all 7-8 episodes are out right now, and they are still, you know, the crazy, like wild, absurd. It has like what are you watching moments. Like there's just like full frontal male nudity. There's like a sentient glory hole, like this, all this stuff. And it was just so much fun to watch, and to see that, like, yeah, they haven't really lost it, but they're embracing different parts. So, and they also happen to have all the old episodes of Kids in the Hall as well too. So, do that, folks. Go and watch Kids in the Hall and learn about some weird, strange comedy. Not for nothing, but Scott Thompson, who is in Kids in the Hall, he was, you know him, he was in Hannibal. And he was one of the FBI agents in Hannibal. Like one of the first, like, openly gay people.
Was he an agent, or he was the autopsy, the medical examiner? Like
he was in the crime lab somehow. Like he was, He was an FBI agent, but he wasn't like
a field agent. Okay. Yeah.
He was in the lab. He actually released a stand-up album where he talked about that. And he's like, I played an FBI agent and they gave me a gun. And, you know, I was a little dramatic. I know what that means. I was like Charlie's Angels when they were teaching me how to handle this gun like an FBI agent. But I didn't realize this until like now, looking back.
He's Alyssa Edwards on the, yes, you know, that
he's
episode.
He's Alyssa Edwards. Scott Thompson is like, he talked about being like openly gay on like cable television and playing openly queer characters, and especially his most famous one that I love, Buddy Cole. Like, it was just so, like, I was like, man, representation does matter. And it is not, I mean, it's not perfect. It's not, they have a sketch starring, I showed this to James. They have a sketch called Running Faggot. And it's like, you know, it's like, four straight men in the Kids in the Hall, plus like Scott Thompson, who's gay. And he's like supposed to be this like folk hero that they have a song for. And it's not great, right? But I understand where they're going with it in terms of like the word and the fact that there is like a folk hero that is like beating up rednecks and, you know, helping children. and his only superpower is that he runs. He just runs away.
Well, I mean, I'm sure if I saw it, I'd find it amusing. So, I mean, obviously today's episode, we're going to be talking about some very complicated queer characters. So, you know, and complexities around the queer identity. So that's totally fine. So I'm excited for everybody who loves Kids in the Hall. And because it's always fun when something gets brought back and, you know, you enjoy it, you know. I mean, is it like, do you think it's successful? Like for.
I think that, I mean, this is also just my point of view, but I think that if you were familiar with them before, you have to watch the documentary, because it made me love it made me appreciate how far they came, because in the second, it's a two-part documentary. And in the second film, they talk about like their rift, like their decade long riff between how Dave Foley ends up getting like booked on other things and how they had a terrible time trying to make their movie and all this stuff, and kind of like how friends became rivals and it was very bitter. And then to see them like get back together and like play together again was just like really great. So I recommend the documentary first, then seeing the new stuff. I think it's effective. I think that they are definitely playing on some nostalgia, but they're not afraid to go to new places.
Very cool.
Especially because, like, you know, they're all older. And so one thing that they talked about was the fact that, like, they're all kind of united in the absurdity of their comedy comes from this idea that, like, comedy is about laughing in the face of death, and that, like, we're all going to die. And that's what makes everything completely absurd, is the fact that, you know, it all will end. And so, you know, let's just laugh along the way. And there was some really deep and poignant things about that, that I was like, huh, I wonder if that's like on some subconscious level, what I connected with in their comedy, in terms of like, this is completely insane, but at the same time, I love it. And
yeah.
Yeah. So
that's definitely my favorite. Yeah. That's definitely my favorite kind of comedy. And I think most comedy is born out of that. You know, there's a lot of tragedy that births comedy because we have to laugh at it, you know, laugh at the absurdities of life, you know, the pettiness, like, you know, we're such a petty species for only living, you know, on average 70 to 80 years. Like, we spend a lot of time. I don't even know if that's average. I just made that up. but it seems we're living longer. So I hope, you know, I'd like to make it to 80 or 90, you know, or even 100. That'd be fun. But regardless, we have pathetically brief lives, is the point in the scheme of things. And we spend a lot of it being petty, and a lot of it being, you know, a lot of it suffering unnecessarily. That's for lots of reasons, you know, not to blame the victims of, you know, the human victims, I mean, of us, you know, not being asked to be born. It's not our fault that, you know, a lot of the tragedies and a lot of the unnecessary suffering happens, but some of it is. So, yeah, I agree with you there. That is my favorite kind of comedy, just to be like, you know, all of this and then you die. So I think that's probably a good place to stop before we.
And on that note.
Yeah, and we will be back to discuss. I'm very excited. This lovely French film, Knife Plus Heart.
I just want to apologize. I'm sorry to everyone. I was very naive and very stupid, and I shouldn't have put other people in danger. I am so sorry for everything that has happened, because in spite of what Joshua says, it's now all my fault. I insisted our listeners subscribe to Fright School on Apple Podcasts. I insisted they leave us reviews. I insisted that they give us a 5-star rating. And it's all because of me that we're here now and we're being hunted. I love you, Mom and Dad. I am so sorry. I only wanted to make good content for our listeners. I'm so scared. I'm going to die out here. Joshua, is that you?
All right, welcome back. First of all, I wanted to bring this up in the first segment. I love your like nails. They're like a nice color, like mine. Look at that. We're doing
blues. Yes, but they are busted though. They are a little dusty. They need to be redone.
It's what happens. Yeah. But very cool. They look good. Oh, that was interesting. They just became part of your background.
Yes. Well, they're like on the blue green spectrum. Yeah. So I think it's just like, you know, they look, it's now it's part of our.
Oh, yeah. Creepy. Alrighty. So today, un couteau dans le cœur, a knife in the heart, or knife plus heart, as it's known in English. 2018, definitely horror thriller. We've got Jan Gonzalez on direction, along with writing it with Christiana Mangione, who are the actors, actresses? Vanessa Paradis, Nicolas Maury, Kate Moran, Jonathan Genet, Roman Bollinger. We got names that I'm just destroying. This is like, you know, a decade of French classes. This is what
I was like, you're reading them like I would be reading them. Why are you not reading them with the affectation, Joshua?
You know, it's always a mix, because it's like, if you do it, you sound pretentious. If you don't, you sound like an idiot. So then I end up doing like a mix where it's like I start up to say something right and then change it to be goofy. I don't know.
You're like Vanessa Paradis.
Paradis. Vanessa Paradis. Super fun. You know, this film competed for the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, or was selected to compete. Did it actually compete? I should have checked that.
It was in the running, but it did not win, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but it was won. So, which is kind of amazing for the type of film it is. And let's see, we've got France, Mexico, Switzerland, all part of the production of it. So great, very international. And it's about a lesbian woman who makes pornographic films, and the actors of her pornographic films are getting murdered.
What?
Joe, what'd you think? Qu'est-ce que tu penses?
What is that? What it means? Is that what you're? Qu'est-ce que c'est?
I think that would be, yeah. What are you thinking?
I do not speak French. I was shockingly enthralled by this film.
It's hard to not watch, like to not look away.
Yes.
I mean,
I loved it. And here's the thing, Joshua. It reminds me so much of movies that I've hated.
Sorry, real quick. I was right. Qu'est-ce que tu penses? What do you think?
Qu'est-ce que tu penses? I thought I would hate it because it reminds me so much of movies that we've seen that I hate. And I really loved it. I would totally
watch
this.
Did you really
again.
Hate Cruising that much?
No, I was thinking about Audition.
I didn't even think about Audition. Very cool. Go ahead. Sorry, I'm gonna keep it.
Well, the reason why I didn't like the films, I'm thinking specifically about films where it's like unreliable. It's unreliable narrator. You don't quite know what is real and what is a dream. You don't quite know, like what is in the narrative, and then what is like it's like. For the benefit of the audience, like at the 5 minutes at the end, like the little summation at the end, where it was like, this is for us to make sure that we understand what the fuck it is that we just watched. But so like, I didn't really care for like Audition in that because of that, or, you know, some other films that we watched, but I really like this. You mentioned pairing this with Cruising. I would not pair this with Cruising. I would pair this with The Love Witch, which we haven't done, but I've seen.
Yeah, I've seen that too. It's very good. We should. We will do that sometime.
Yeah,
that is,
we should do that.
Film. Yeah.
But I really, really liked it. It was just like the perfect amount of camp. I was primed for it right after Cruising, so I was able to understand the references. I definitely felt like, I mean, like, I understand giallo. I mean, if I did not have any basis or any root of giallo, I would not probably appreciated this. But I liked it. I liked it a lot. I would probably watch this again.
Yay! Well, we love that. We need somewhere. We need to make like a board that's like, what will Joe watch again, and like make a list. I should put that in the newsletter. Which reminds me. Subscribe to our newsletter below, because not only do you get fun, you know, missives from us, but we also reveal the month of episodes that's coming up, give you previews for other things. So super fun. So definitely there's a link in our everywhere. So looking for our link tree. Also in the show notes, there's a link. But I should definitely put that in there. Like, yay, we got another one. Because I feel like it's only like once or twice a year anymore that we really get like one you're going to watch again. So very cool. I guess when I was saying cruising, it's just because the whole opening of cruising and this are like identical. You know, it's basically the same. So I was just like, oh man, this would be fun to kind of pair these together somehow. But I like the idea of the Love Witch or other movies that kind of, you know, hype on that sort of the vibe. One of the next things I wrote was like, the lighting is gorgeous. You know, very giallo versus like the 80s. Like it's such a nice, like those intense reds and the blues and just the color of this film is gorgeous. The way An is dressed, gosh, her aesthetic is so cool for the most part, until like the picnic scene where suddenly she's like fuzzy mother, like she's wearing like pastels, like what's happening here? But it was cute. It was a different look for, you know, the leather skirts and stuff she was wearing.
Yeah, like patent leather trench coat. Like, come on. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And the skirt and like the shirt kind of tucked and oversized. Her hair. Just, yeah, I really dug the way she looked. And yeah, it just had like a real complexity to the characters. And again, the other reason I wanted to pair this with cruising and again, I'm really glad that we chose this lineup because I didn't anticipate it. I feel like I watched Knife Plus Heart like a year ago, year and a half ago. And I first seen Cruising a long, long time ago. So watching that again and then watching this right after it, I was like, oh, wow, this is a nice seg. But the reason is because, again, it's another look at like a really specific part of queer culture and identity that is, you know, so often not, you know, not wanting to be shown. You know, or hidden away or shunned or whatnot. So, and that's like the making of pornography, which, again, I think I've talked about before on the podcast, but you know, no shame. I didn't do pornography, but I worked for an adult entertainment company for a while in sales you know, all of that kind of stuff, memberships and product. And so there were times watching this that it gave me like some flashbacks to that. I was just like, oh man, I remember. Because everything was kind of housed in the same place. So like my offices and like the storerooms and all of that were like right next to where they were filming. And so it was kind of weird to walk through those areas. And, you know, every week or, you know, every month they'd be totally different places, you know, because they'd have to build the sets and change the sets around. And, you know, then they rented a house and kind of the same thing. There were lots of bedrooms that they changed into different places and venues. So there were just moments of this that it felt very immediate to me, even though it's been quite a few years since I worked there. So fun, right?
Yeah.
It is like that. That's like this show. That is kind of what it's like. There is a certain, and the other thing is that it's not erotic. This is another film that is like, there's all this pornography and stuff on display and like flesh, but it's like not erotic. There was nothing like sexy about this film, which again, if you're like part of the industry, it's kind of the same. Like it really is like some people on a bed doing what they're doing with a bunch of other people standing around, like either directing or like lighting and doing stuff. So there's just a real flatness to it, you know, just a lack of eroticism.
I push back on that because I think that might be your lived experience having worked in the industry. I think that I see what you're saying in terms of like they're playing up the scenes for the camp value of it more than anything and again, the heightened nature. But I felt like all of the seductions right before the murders were very erotic. And just, I mean, also that's like part of
cruising. Oh, I'm sorry. Right? I meant the filming parts, like when they would show the filming going on. So it just felt very real to me because I'm like, yeah, that is kind of what it feels like. Like, you know, just you're doing your job and people are doing this in the other room and you're just kind of like, whatever, you know, or you walk through the sets and it just felt very much like that kind of that situation. But I agree with the other parts. Yes, there is a lot of sexy seduction going on in other parts of the film, but not when it comes to the pornography.
No.
That's very interesting.
It's not until the very end. It's not until the last, the final, her like, you know, where she makes peace with Lois.
Right. Yeah. Lois. Yeah.
Which is like, oh, it's like, okay, so now we get it. And yeah, it's so great. And I just love that, like, you know, she's like, are you on Perez? I like, you know, I love your films. This is your magnum opus. And I'm like, oh my God, like some, you know, man in a blue movie theater is like, I've seen all your films. It was so camp in that way, but like the storytelling was strange. Like there's a lot of like really fantastical elements. That's why it reminded me so much of The Love Witch. Mm-hmm. Because of that, I'm just like, I know they're playing this seriously and straight. So, you know, I was not really inclined to like laugh or whatever, or think it was, I mean, there's comedic moments, but definitely not, that's not what they're going for. But it was just so much fun. It was just also like just a fun little romp, just a fun, like, this is one of those movies that you put on and it's like a date night. Like I would put this on as like a date night movie. Mainly because it's just like, it's the heightened feelings of it all too. Like I just thought it was really cool. Yeah.
This is a movie I would definitely play at a party with like electronic music over it. Cause the score is great. And there were so many other bands. I was thinking like, oh man, it'd be so fun to like use this as visual art and play other music over it. So like this, The Love Witch is another, cause the aesthetic is nice. It's, you know, it's not necessarily about following. And then like Suspiria is one like that too, where it's like, oh man, I just love to put that on the background and in a dark room with the lights and stuff of it. It works really well for like ambiance at a party. And this is like one of those, cause I don't feel it's too gory. Like there are some scenes that are violent, obviously. And the police like talk about what happens to the victims. But it, in and of itself, it's definitely not like French New Extremism, you know, New Extremity. You know, this isn't like Martyrs, not like High Tension. The blood, again, is very giallo as it spills out and artfully around bodies and stuff. You know, it's very that.
You don't really see the killing. Like you see, you see some of it, but you don't really see the penetration for the most part.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think the most that you see is when the killer, Guy, kills the trans actress in the field, because you see the knife go through.
And then you kind of see it hanging out of her back. They have two different names in the film. Martine is when they're before they transition, because they're,
and then I think it's Marisa.
Misha. That is, but that's like as bad as it gets. And even in that moment, it's such like, because the killer's like approaching from behind and the camera whirs around in a circle and then comes back as they get closer. Mm-hmm. It's such an artful, like beautiful moment in the film, obviously while something really horrible happens, but I was quite taken with that scene, all of it. I mean, I just thought it was a really cool movie. And then on top of it, it adds like, you know, almost everybody in the film, you know, all the major actors portray queer people. I don't know about their real lives. I did not, you know, research or find out, but there's a lot of complexity to them, especially on, you know, she's like this clearly a creative force. You know, she's making these very artistic kinds of pornographic films. They've, you know, there's like there's a giallo element to some of them, even. You know, she takes her real life and kind of turns it into pornography or pulls from life. You know, she's made like 8 movies or something, so she must be doing well enough, because, you know, to fund the films.
Yeah.
Plus it's the 70s. You know, so we do have some, you know, some of that at play. But then she has this like relationship with Louise, as you said earlier, McKenna, Kate Moran, probably, who they've broken up, but she's her editor. And An is like obsessed with her and is like really violent towards her, doing weird stuff with the editing, you know, writing stuff to her. Tu m'as touché, you've murdered me, you've killed me. And then, you know, there's like that ultimate scene between them after the picnic where there's like the storm and she like tracks her down and like assaults her. like sexually assaults her and tells her her, you know, her body belongs to her, her parts belong to her. It's such an intense, scary scene. And I don't really think, I was trying to think if I've really seen that in films before with like lesbian actresses. Now, I've had that happen in my personal life. Like, obviously, most of us have known people that have, you know, have been in these sorts of situations. So I've seen that play out before between friends, but I was like, I don't think I've ever seen that on film. You know, people kind of want to like act as if the queer community doesn't have these issues, you know, doesn't have domestic violence issues, or, you know, like at least our media seems to, you know, kind of downplay that. And even like with the police and stuff, some, you know, they don't always want to get involved. That's, you know, a problem, you know, when it's between queer people. I'm sure that's shifting. I'm sure it's changing, but it definitely used to be a thing. Like, don't bother with the police. Like, what are they going to do? I mean, not as if they do much for a lot of straight women, obviously, or at least women in relationships with violent men. But that's all other conversation. So I was just like, wow, there's a lot happening in this film that is not normal. I feel not normally a part of queer conversation. So I was curious what you thought about that. Cause you just went in blind and just watched it. So that must have been shocking.
The only thing I knew about it was the trailer that I saw, like, you know, last year or whenever it came out. And I have to say, you make some good points. Like, I think that this is, especially right after Cruising, like, this is a great film that's also, like, the sheer ineptitude of the police, right? Like, it's this...
Yeah.
And like, just the power, too, that On has when she basically takes her life experience with the police and turns it into porn. Like, yeah, that I'm just like, oh, you know, the pleat, like, thumb in your eye at that. But then I think it's also,
which,
like,
again, real quick, echoes some of that stuff in Cruising when the two police officers sexually assault the,
yeah,
we believe, the trans women by forcing them to, you know, do sex acts so they don't have to go to jail. So I thought, again, that was another thing where I'm like, wow, that's like another echo of something 40 years apart.
Ish.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That is still obviously kind of something to discuss, but sorry, go ahead.
And then you have, like, I think that what connects the two, besides like the obvious, like, visual, like, homages that the Knifeless Heart has, is the idea that, like, well, no, the police don't protect us, we protect us. And that's, like, most evident in the final scene. So I don't think we talked about it. I just want to go back really quickly. So for folks who have not seen this film, like, the plot is that a serial killer is murdering gay porn actors and subsequently is also going after the director On. And in the final moments when the killer is revealed themselves, it's all of the gay patrons of this theater that, like, do him in and end up, like, dispatching him in this, like, very cathartic, like, community way of, like, no, we protect, like, this woman made things for us, we protect her, and this is how we protect ourselves because the police have not been doing anything. And it's just so fascinating how, like, that's the through line, right? And again, completely different culture, France versus, you know, France versus United States.
Totally.
But still, like, that calling into that queer experience of, like, violence and the idea that, like, of mutual aid and, like, we take care of ourselves. No one's the cavalry is not coming. We are the cavalry. We have to help. We take care of ourselves. Which I thought, like, while sad because of its truth, is also quite beautiful in how it's quite beautiful in how they are dispatched and in terms of, like, this big community way. And then all the stuff with, like this gaggle of trans women who are all sex workers that have, like, just, like, the description that Marisha is giving of each of her sisters. And it's, like, you know, It's like she'll be like, the Arabian Beauty. I think that was my favorite line. It's like, the Arabian Beauty, she promises you 1,000 nights, but you're done in 2 licks.
Yeah.
I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. And just like the idea that, like, you know, hey everybody, we're done making this porno. We're gonna go have a picnic in the countryside. And then they're just like all laying on each other, this like beautifully composed tableau of like of like Parisian sex workers eating grapes from each other. Like, it was just so it was so beautiful and
pastoral. Like,
pastoral, idyllic. And I mean, Joshua, did you ever have, like, when you worked at the adult film company, did you ever, like, you know, go to a field?
You almost said the name, didn't you?
I almost did. I don't want to get sued. Not going to get sued. When you worked there, did you like, you know, eat grapes from one another in a pastoral field for like a company bonding picnic? Or,
you know, not exactly, but it was such a weird situation there, because like we would keep like wine in the place. So it was like, we would like have a few glasses of wine in the middle of the day, smoke, you know what, do other things. And there were beanbag chairs everywhere. So yeah, there actually were quite a few times where it's like, if there was a lull or something was finished, it was like, let's just like hang out. Let's order food. Let's all go out somewhere. So it was very familial in a way. Plus I was close friends with several of the people that worked there, outside, even before I came in. That's how I got the job. It's probably how most people get the job, is they know somebody who like already is in it and they need like somebody to, you know, do the work. And, yeah, so actually it was kind of like at times, and I like that with the full-time workers that were there. I didn't like when the models were involved. I think that's a big problem in the industry, and it still isn't, you know, probably big because it's such a turnover. You know, it's not like these people could come and work there for years, because the patrons get bored, you know, the subscribers get bored. They're paying, you know, monthly fees, or they're buying the videos. They don't want to see the same people. You know, again, that's why Pornhub and all these other like things are so popular, is because there's millions of new faces constantly, you know. So it's like, it was awkward sometimes with the models. So not awkward in the sense of like, I don't care what they were doing. I mean, they could all do whatever they were doing. We could go out somewhere, but I just think the boundaries got blurred sometimes, which again is one of the reasons I left and wanted to pursue mental health career, was to be more supportive of people in that industry to some degree. But that's a whole other conversation. To one of your points, though, when you were talking about America versus France, what I like is, like, it's not much different. Everywhere in the world, you find hatred for queer people. And obviously, I know that's not what you were saying, that, like, France might not be the same, but it is, or it was, at least. So the writer-director said, in France, it has been violent with gay marriage, which was only, like, 4 or 5 years ago. And then there were lots of people in the streets against gay marriage, like straight families with kids, thousands of people protesting, lots of protests. This to me was super violent. So in the story, Guy has fallen in love with this other boy. They seem very young to me in the story, Isham. And so they're in Isham. Yeah. So they're in the barn, you know, diddling, and Guy's father finds them and he murders Isham. The description said castrate, but if you watch the movie, it's like full emasculation. So it's like, cuts that all off, sets the barn on fire, and leaves these boys, you know, his son, to die. And so the assault turns Guy into a monster. And, you know, he takes on this identity, this Giallo identity, almost as a switchblade killer, which, again, it is very Giallo, black gloves, the knife. It reminds me of a lot of the Giallo movies that we saw. And with no strong police presence to stop him, he does so with ease. So that whole storyline is very interesting. But also it adds a little bit a confusing message to the story. So I like your point about, you know, we have to protect ourselves because the police aren't going to do, you know, they're not going to help. They're not doing anything. You include like the feather, like, so the police finds the feather, the, you know, officer gives it to her and he's like, oh, it's going to take weeks of testing. And she's like, I'm going to go to a fucking aviary, a beautiful fucking aviary, by the way. Oh my gosh, that was incredible. The sets in this film, the indoor, outdoor, wherever they are. Oh my gosh. Like,
visual. You're talking about the pyramid.
Yeah. Yes. When she like goes into that and this whole like nature reserve, I think of it as an aviary because of the bird and then the bird dude with the bird hand and the whole, like, very interesting, but figures it out in 2 seconds. So again, police are completely useless because they have to, again, go like that. They don't need to wait for tests. Take the feather to the damn aviary down the street. You recognize this? Can you help me identify it?
Well, hold on. Like, it's a feather that he kept. I always keep a trophy from my cases.
Right,
I
was like, strange.
look here, Dexter. Like,
right.
And he puts it in this like lovely, like red, like cushioned box. And then, you know, Birdman comes and it's just a whole thing. I thought that the woman who was the head of the aviary, or assuming head of the aviary, she looked like La Femme Morte from Inside. Oh.
Yes, she did. Yeah, yeah. And she was like, you know, there were some times where in this film that was kind of mystical. It's like, is Anne having prophetic dreams? Is she just remembering hearing the story? And she had made, you know, this film years ago based on it. You know, there, you know, there's the whole thing with Misha with the, you know, where she's holding her hand and kind of telling her things that do sort of come. So there is like a weird mystical element to this movie, but which again, it's like, I don't know how to think, because overall the plot, it's kind of confusing. Like not the plot. The plot is not confusing. We know what's happening by the end of it. Guy is hunting down the people involved in exploiting, you know, his story, this great love story for him, this tragedy of his life, you know, that's left him horribly disfigured, has left him without love, without, you know, he's totally ashamed of, or not ashamed, but, you know, just he's fucked. His life is super fucked up. And you know, so there's like this part of it that's really beautiful and sad. And then the other part where it's like, yeah, he's this, like, he becomes this villain who's killing, you know, other queer people. Because either he's, you know, well, again, I think it's mostly because he's angry that they've exploited and not told his story correctly. Because obviously in her film, the father walks in and they all have an orgy instead of murdering each other, which makes sense. It's a porn.
but he also, like, he was an amnesiac, right? So like he,
right.
Because the crows, the blind crows, like, nursed him back to health in the, like, forest where people go to die. Yeah. Again, as I'm saying it, I was like, I shouldn't like this movie. I shouldn't like it because this has all the makings of those types of films that I hate. And yet, I really do like it.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's The Crow, you know, like this is like The Crow meets like a little bit of Cruising, Audition. I do like that. You know, there's fuzziness, even like at the beginning, because Anne and Guy have a very, like, they're parallels of each other. You know, they sort of echo each other, you know, just in like love and like this psychotic, manic love for another person causes them to create all this destruction around them. And like, she's not even like, these people care about this person, you know, they might be sex workers or and pornographic actors, but she just comes in and it's like, all right guys, so what was his name, the first one who dies,
Carl.
Carl dies. So Carl is dead, stabbed in the rectum by the police. So what we're gonna do is make a new movie based on Carl's murder. Let's all go move around. And these people are just like, what the f-? And so she's doing that, this thing, exploiting the very real lives as they keep dying. She's like, you know, making this film, pornographic film about them. Again, they're pornographic actors. So I guess it's kind of documentary or, you know, biopic. I don't know. It's very fucked up is what it is. So she's creating all of this other devastation. She's like attacking her, you know, ex-girlfriend. She herself is an agent of chaos. And then so is Guy, but both of them have this like intense love for another person, and like that is wrapped up in the tragedy, which is why it's kind of weird at the end when he's murdered by all the other, like, you know, patrons of this place. So it kind of, again, there's an echoing, because the father kills him out of like a homophobic rage, and then it's like, I don't know, it doesn't read exactly like internalized homophobia, but like I feel like there's something in there about that, you know, with his death being the way it is. He's not killed by An, he's not avenged by, or he's not killed in a vengeance way by somebody who was like a, you know, related to a victim. So it's kind of a weird thing, which leads me to one of the articles I read for this tries to make the case, but I think it's really, really muddy because of what's happening. So I'm not sure I exactly agree with this take, but this is from Collider by Chris Sasagwe, wrote that Knife Plus Heart used the giallo genre to talk about the AIDS epidemic. So again, we're in the 70s. So this is before the AIDS epidemic was really happening, you know, on like, I mean, it was there. HIV existed, people were getting it, but it was still a while before it was like identified, like things I think were happening possibly as early as the mid 70s. So, and he makes points like the authorities took on the role of bystander rather than protector, going to your point about like, you know, need to protect each other because nobody else is going to. You know, the AIDS crisis for nearly two decades, the AIDS crisis was left unchecked by those in positions of power. As the virus ravaged the gay community's bodies, global governments were slow to react. So in Knife Plus Heart, the marginalization is displayed on a smaller scale. By using a formulaic giallo plot, Knife Plus Heart mirrors this movement, meaning like ACT UP and things like that, featuring an amateur detective attempting to solve murders rather than the police. As in real life, the authorities, the murderer can be seen as a stand-in for the virus itself, faceless danger that taints sexual freedom, with law enforcement nowhere in sight. The movie's finale, set at an adult theater, is a symbolic act of defiance. You know, when realizing the killers among them, the young gay attendees rise together to permanently end the murderer's reign of terror. If no one will protect them, the community will take care of themselves. Obviously, we know like lesbian women had a major role to play in like caring for queer men who were dying of AIDS and others. You know, so I can see where some of that is. But the problem is that the killer himself is a victim of like a horrific homophobic act who is responding to the exploitation of that and just to the general rage of like not being, you know, maybe there could be a case for like these people are free in their sexuality and they're open. Nobody's punishing them for it. So he is, because of his own, he's been robbed of it. So again, like I can talk more about like, you know, internalized homophobia or the anger of like, you know, of wanting to rob other people of their freedom. But I have a hard time seeing this as an AIDS conversation when the killer themselves, like it kind of gets muddy, you know?
Well, I don't think, having not read the article, right? Like, I don't think that this person is taking into account like the personhood or the sentience of the killer, right?
Right.
So If you do that in the same way that, you know, a virus is not like, doesn't discriminate, does not have sentience, like in this way, for that particular point of analysis, you complicate it. I say that in like, in terms of an argument, not like in terms of Fright School where we overcomplicate everything. But,
like, right.
You're complicating it by adding the fact that like at the core of this film, or at the core of why the killer Guy is doing what he's doing is because of like seeking out the vengeance from the trauma, and ultimately like the supposed, see, from my thing, it's like it's also kind of like a misunderstanding and kind of a coincidence, because An like just so happened to like create the plot for this film, and it stars all of the people who have been murdered, and you know, that's where she realizes like, oh look, it's this thing. And it's interesting because like she doesn't know that she did it. I mean, that's adding to the mysticism of, you know, the prophetic nature of it. But like, it's all a misunderstanding. Like she, you know, he's saving her for laughs because it's like, oh, you know, you did this to me. And like you're laughing at my love story, not only my love story, but also my trauma.
Right.
And so in a way, it's like, you know, he, in the same way that like the rules of horror, right, is that you, even if there is justification for something, for the cosmicness of how shitty, like how like something shitty has been done to you, you also, because you're perpetrating murder, you also must pay in that same way as well. This is why, like, the original ending of Dexter doesn't work, right? The original ending of Dexter doesn't work, and what ended up being the series finale of Dexter doesn't work, because in the intended ending, it was supposed to be like a finality to the idea that, like, by committing murder, you have also condemned yourself. Right. So in that way, I think, like, I hear what you're saying, and we, you know, like, we want to recognize and honor that. But at the same time, like, you know, we can't let in the rules of horror, by committing murder, you have now, and it's not like self-defense, right? It's not like Sidney Prescott killing the killers at the end.
Right.
Yeah,
I just thought it was an interesting conversation, again, like, to kind of talk about this particular killer as, you know, as like a signifier of like the AIDS epidemic or HIV crisis. I saw it was a little odd. Again, I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, we can make an argument. I'm just, you know, like, if you personify like viruses, it can be seen as like an attempt by the earth to protect itself from us, from human invasion. But I don't think that this is a deep film in a lot of ways, but I think that might be a little too, especially because it's not set during that time. Nobody mentions HIV or AIDS during the film. Not that they have to. Again, we talked about The Fly, you know, being a conversation about AIDS, cancer, you know, other sorts of disease. But again, because it's set in a specific time, it's not as if they mention it. It doesn't have to. It's just that these are also, in my opinion, the story would need to have that conversation, because this is pornography being made. And, you know, that is, you know, very much a conversation. Like, if you're making sex films and you have a virus raging in the community that is killing people, you know, because of, you know, sex, then there would have been a little bit more conversation about it in the film, and there's not. So I feel like the film itself is ignoring, you know, any conversation about, at least that I remember. Do you remember any conversation in the film where it's like, oh, we got to wear condoms because we might, you know, die? I don't remember that conversation happening at all in the film.
I don't know. They did not have those conversations. Yeah. But are you saying that I'm struggling to understand what it is that you mean, because it does not feel like, are you saying that like your interpretation, the article is saying that it's like a rhetorical analysis of like the killer is the virus, not like a literal virus, not like a pathogen.
No, I get it. I'm just saying that I struggle with the reading of that because of the timing of the film, because of when it's taking place and the type of like the story itself. So it's like, I just feel like, I'm not sure that the director or the writers were thinking at all about that. Again, you're right. That's not the point. I mean, the whole point of like analyzing film and talking about what it might be saying, this absolutely could have some legitimacy. It's just for me that I didn't think about it at all during the film, like as something that might, the conversation might be about AIDS HIV, you know.
The film is a modern film, right? So it could be something that's just kind of baked in, or they just didn't want to do something about that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I mean, to also, like, you know, On's credit is that On is a very much like, you know, On is like Gary Marshall. Like, this is like the Gary, like a lesbian pornographer, Gary Marshall, where, you know, she's working with the same actors. So like from a health and safety OSHA standpoint, you're like working with the same people. So there is a confidence and a trust that's built among those same people, except when she brings in Nan, who looks like Fouad, which, like, I love a big French name, like Nan and Fouad, and like couldn't get anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe then that, like, I don't want to totally dismiss the analysis. I just struggled with like seeing that as the conversation, especially because the killer wasn't like, you know, somebody outside the community killing people. I would have an easier time with that. You know, again,
homophobia.
Yeah, I was saddened by the end, you know, and I wrote, I was like, this whole thing is so tragic. It's just terrible, you know. Again, he didn't have the right to kill people, obviously, you know, but I just felt really sad in the end for him and his story. And again, this is another one of those films like Cruising, where the horror, not only is this queer horror, because it's clearly a very queer story. It's about, you know, gay pornography and lesbians. There's a lot going on. Oh, by the way, that lesbian bar that she goes to, incredible. I want to go there. Oh my gosh, so cool. And I want to meet that bartender and her weird vest jacket thing. I love the whole thing. But it's also, this is also a very tangible, like, you know, discussion of homophobia and its ramifications that still occur today. People are still murdered around the world for being gay. Here, obviously, people are beat up and murdered, you know, for being anywhere on the queer spectrum. It happens, you know, so it's just, there's just so much, like, tangible stuff in this, even though it's set in the 70s and about, like, you know, this kind of really specific thing. But there are a lot of really universal themes in it. I just thought, man, this is such a cool movie. So again, maybe that is the thing. Maybe I guess I'm saying that, and I'm sure other people listening to our episodes have been like, that's too far, Joshua and Joe. I feel like the talking about AIDS, HIV in relation to this, as if the killer embodies that. I'm like, I don't know. It might be a little too far, but again, all viewings, all opinions I do feel are valid. So I just didn't feel that in my watching of it.
Yeah, I think you're correct. I side with you in that regard, because I think that this is one of those situations where it's like, if I was an English teacher or a film teacher, right, reading an essay, and this was the film that we had to watch, if someone made that, I'd be like, I have too many questions, because like the whole, like the like tenderest, the most tender moment of the film at the very end, the resolution, the denouement is like all about the killer. And having sympathy and empathy for the killer. And one thing, and then, you know, we can start wrapping this up, is that like the killer and Ahn have a lot in common, in the sense they're both sympathetic monsters.
Yes.
Ahn, you get that, you know, because like her, you can sense the desperation that she wants to be with Lois.
Well, that's one of the first early things you hear one of her coworkers say. She's a monster. Yeah.
You're a monster. You're a monster. You're a monster. And then the killer is like, you only see the monstrosity. It's not until the very end that you realize this is tragic. Like, this is a tragic story. And I think because the film gives that killer so much backstory, I don't think it's fair to say that this is just like some mindless disease that's killing indiscriminately. So yeah, I don't know. If I was an English teacher, I would give that paper a C-.
I probably wouldn't, because I'd be like, well, hey, you know, you tried to pull out some stuff. That's cool. You know, I would want it to be really supported. Maybe there's an argument out there for that. That like, well, that's fine. It can still, you know, and whatever. But I like that point a lot. Is because in the end, there it is like this sympathetic monstrosity at play. That makes it a really beautiful film that you didn't expect, because you're like, pornographic actors murdered by mass killer. It doesn't read as something that's going to remind you of like the Phantom of the Opera, you know, or something. And it's very much in that vein.
Yeah. So I want to ask a fun question about your time in the adult film industry.
Okay.
Was there a person at your company, or the company you worked for, not your company, but the company you worked for, was there a person who was like Bouche d'Or?
Oh, right. Bouche d'Or. It was funny when that, it translate, you know, like the subtitles, like Mouth of Gold. And I was like,
bring the Mouth of Gold. I was like, what?
I was like, I don't know if it would be translating so specifically. I felt like maybe there was something else at play, because I was trying to figure out how the French say like gay for pay, and without saying like, you know, like really straightforward, like gay for pay, you know, like translation. you know, like gay contre remuneration. Like that's like direct. So I was like trying to find if there were other like fun ways that they might say that, but I didn't really find anything. So if you speak French and know like a slang for that, like I was wondering, is there something that's, you know, oh, like homo pour du fric is one. Homosexuel pour l'argent. Again, that's very direct, very like gay for money. Mm-hmm. Tant que gay. Gay pour la paix. See, these are a little more.
You're not answering the question, Joshua.
Anyways, sorry. It's because I was really distracted by the subtitle because I was like, would they really call him that? Or would it like, is it more like golden mouth instead of bring mouth of gold? Like that just sounded weird to me. Anyways, my point is fluffers. No. I don't remember.
Wait, explain for the straights what a fluffer is.
The straights know what a fluffer is because I think that exists more even in straight culture, in straight porn than, you know. So a fluffer is usually somebody on who helps the actors between takes, between sets, stay hard or stay aroused or whatever. I'm sure they do for everybody, all gender spectrum people. I'm sure fluffers exist to help them out. We never had one. I never worked anywhere that had a fluffer, as far as I know. I also was not on set, so maybe, you know, part of the crew would do that, but there was nobody hired to sit around waiting to, like, yeah, blow actors. No.
I mean, they also have, like, Viagra, right? Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I mean, well, I don't know. I don't, yeah, like, yeah, you know, let's not get,
well,
into
in my
it,
company, but the company I was working for was, like, the actors were young, so that wasn't a problem. As far as I know, they were mostly like ready to go. Like, I don't remember ever somebody being like, you know, we have a problem because they, you know, can't get an erection. I remember more, we'd have a problem because of improper douching. That would be a real problem. But those are very specific to like queer, you know, gay. This was gay pornography. So no, I don't remember ever seeing a fluffer around. I don't know if that's still a thing. I feel like people make jokes about it, especially in like the 70s and 80s. So I don't know if that's like a real job. This guy wasn't even a real job. He was like, I live with my mother. I do this for free. Like, okay, yeah, queen, go off. Pop off, sis.
Here comes a quaint Guam story. When we would say the rosary for the dead, the Catholic rosary for the dead, there'd be like a litany that you do. And the litany is like, you know, has all these different things. It's like, so, you know, like, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, pray for us, house of gold. And so when they said mouth of gold, I was like, immediately they'd house of gold and made me start thinking about wanting to pray for the dead, which just, you know, is delightful. And someone listening to this who is from Guam is going to know exactly what I'm talking about. And this moment is for them.
I love that. I think that's really special. Very, very, very special. I'm glad that a film like this could bring such a quaint memory, life moment, life experience to your mind. Just looking here, I don't really have any other notes. You know, be careful, you know, not to be destroyed by the things that you love and not to destroy them as well.
And monkeypox.
Right. And watch out for monkeypox. Joe, as always, I enjoy you. You're a delight. Dear listener or viewer, if you're viewing this very voyeuristically, thank you as always. Thank you for your support on Patreon. Thank you for watching the show. Thank you for sharing us with your friends, following us.
Now do it all in French.
I should have. Merci beaucoup. Bonsoir. Good night.
Fromage.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davy Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.